Hello and welcome to the podcast portion of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, previews, reviews, and interviews with baseball authors, artists, filmmakers, musicians, anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture. Because that's our slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. George Castle is one of the busiest baseball writers I know. Within the space of 3 months, he has 2 books coming out. Baseball's Game Changers, Icons, Record Breakers, Scandal, Sensational Series, and More. That came out on February 18th and deals with, as the name implies, some of the biggest game-changing events in the history of the game. And then the other one coming out on April 1st is Jackie Robinson West, The Triumph and Tragedy of America's Favorite Little League Team. In between his many projects, George managed to find some time to talk with the Baseball Bookshelf. George Castle, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Well, thank you for having me on with you, Ron.
I found myself saying for this one, baseball's game changers. I went through each of the 50, and I said, yep, this is a game changer. This is a game changer. But not all of the game changers that you write in this one are good, are they?
No, they change the game for better or for worse, Ron. Baseball is not a bed of roses, and there were things that happened in the game that set it back or gave it a bad name for a while. But they changed the course of the game, again, for better or for worse, and they have to be dealt with honestly.
Now, you go about it in an unusual way. When I first opened it up, I just flipped through it without reading it, and I was wondering, well, is it going to be a countdown, or is it going to be a count up? And you split it. You did the top five and then everything else.
Well, that was actually the choice of the editors of the book, and I had a tremendous editor in Keith Wallman. I've worked with him on 2 other books for Lions Press going back to 2008. It was his choice not to just give away the store with their number one rating off the bat. They want the people, I guess this is the shorter attention span of the 21st century, to go 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and then, you know, from there on out, you've got 6 through 50. I guess that's a new age type of way of presenting it, of holding the reader's attention. I guess when they're selling the book, if you're looking at it in a bookstore or looking at it in an airport newsstand, you're flipping through it, and it's a way of continuing to flip through it until you find that number one.
Now, there are levels of change. Some affect the can actually affect the outcome of a game, like video replay, the year of the pitcher throwing overhand. Those are just some of the things that actually affect the game on the field. Some affect strategies, such as the designated hitters or specialized relievers, and even sabermetrics. I mean, who is the sabermetrics for? Is that for the fan or the front office? And some affect the way the game is perceived. I think the most interesting chapter to me personally was the decline of newspapers. And could you explain that a little bit?
Well, it's certainly affected me personally. I was a 20-year baseball writer for a suburban Chicago newspaper, and they eventually, you know, continue to cut coverage, as has happened with newspapers all over. I think one of the big problems is that baseball is living in a TV rights-fueled bubble, and they don't realize that baseball is an expensive sport to cover and that they are actually suffering a huge decline in the number of outlets doing original content covering baseball, and it's not being replaced by new age online outlets. Let's say there's not ChicagoBaseball.com with beat writers covering the Cubs or Sox, or NewYorkBaseball.com, and actually even some of the new age baseball outlets have retrenched. Fox Sports laid off its entire regional sports writing staff. And there are actually 3 writers last year who are members of the writer's wing of the Hall of Fame, the Spink Award winners, who lost their gigs. So it's affected everybody, and the fan has less diversity in coverage. There's less competition in coverage, and it means that baseball teams and the establishment in New York can control coverage a lot more with less competition.
What's your take on bloggers? Is that a game changer? Is that good for the game or bad for the game or a mixed blessing?
It's a mixed blessing because the bloggers are, in many cases, not professionals. They're just people with opinions, and the democratization of the Internet gives everybody access to it. But what are your qualifications? Do you have training? Have you paid your dues? Usually the baseball beat was at the end of the rainbow. You had to work your way up to it. And do these people have the standards of doing it? Plus, baseball is still not welcoming to all these bloggers. There are some teams that are so strict they don't want to have these fanboys or people who are rah-rah-rah fans having any kind of contact with their players, and they don't let them in. So to me, you can say everybody has an opinion, but what kind of concrete information or quotes or opinions is that analysis based on?
Now, I know you're talking about the three writers who are Spink Award winners. One who is not in the group you mentioned is Murray Chass, who took a buyout from the New York Times several years ago. He is vehemently anti-blogger, and he has a web presence that he refuses to describe as a blog, even though it kind of is. But you know where he's coming from. He's coming from exactly the same place you are, is for the credentials of a great percentage of these bloggers. I want to turn now to I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit, and I want to talk about some of the specifics in the book, and I ask you to defend your choices here. So put you on the spot.
Fifth Amendment, I plead it, and but I won't. I'll talk this time and not zip my lip like the gangsters of old.
All right, Jackie Robinson is understandably in the top five. In fact, he's one of the top two, but I won't say which one. He's an obvious choice, but Frank Robinson is manager. How is that a game changer?
Well, there was a color ceiling. There was a color ceiling. Players could players of color, both African Americans and Latins, could manage, or I should say could play, but they had scarce opportunities to continue in the game. There were just a few coaches starting in the 60s, and there was no way for them to really rise in the game after their careers. There had been talk about a black manager as far back as 1951, when I had a Collier's magazine which projected Jackie Robinson being the 1960 manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers. They never factored in that they might move to the West Coast. But there was no way for these great players to continue in the game. It had been talked about and talked about and talked about, and nobody would actually hire an African-American manager. I'll give you a quick example. John Hairston, who was Jerry Hairston's Jerry Hairston Jr. and Scott Hairston's uncle, was told by coaches as a minor leaguer in 1969 that you might want to get into managing, that there should be a black manager coming soon. You want to stay in the game. You're a smart guy. But nobody would take the first step and appoint a manager until Frank Robinson, who was not considered the first choice or a logical choice with his intense personality to be that, you know, groundbreaker. So now players, great players, either black or Latin, now have a way to continue their careers and contribute to the game, and that's why I think that having a manager of color was certainly a game changer.
Okay, the next one on my list is Michael Jordan.
Michael Jordan was the ultimate Pied Piper. Oddly enough, a guy who baseball was his first sport, he was a top little leaguer in North Carolina, was so magnetic, so powerful as a basketball player, he lured so many minority kids away from baseball in the 80s. Baseball was thriving at the youth level in the 80s, and then Jordan came along, and now they all wanted to be like Mike. And I don't know if this is relating to any questions to come, but Michael Jordan was not counteracted by any comparable baseball player.
Okay, William L. Vec, Bill Vec's father?
William L. Vec was a tremendous innovator as Cubs president, and he built a Cubs winner. And the Cubs haven't been the same since he died a premature death at 56 in 1933. He permitted broadcasting of baseball at a time when a lot of owners felt that radio would impact the gate. At 1.7 stations broadcast Cubs games without a rights fee in the early 1930s. That spread the popularity of the game far and wide and made the Cubs a regional draw. Eventually, the other owners caught on. He built the female fan base in baseball through Ladies' Day. Before, baseball was just a bunch of cigar-smoking guys gambling and, you know, a boys' club in the game, and it's further increased the fan base. He also pioneered the use of selling tickets away from the ballpark. Not everybody could actually go to the ballpark to buy tickets, and this enabled the game to spread its popularity by making tickets much more available to purchase. So he was a very innovative guy. He helped bring in Kennesaw Mountain Landis as the first commissioner. He advocated the All-Star game and interleague play many decades before it was instituted. So for long-lasting things in the game, Ron, I think he was even more influential than his Barnum Bill son. Plus, he made the Cubs a winner, and they haven't been the same because P.K. Wrigley appointed himself president of the Cubs. He didn't know anything about baseball for want of finding another William L. Vec.
The next one on my list is the 1975 World Series.
Unbelievable. The drama, the swings, and not just the famous Carlton Fisk home run in Game 6. I think baseball was struggling to reestablish itself as a dynamic sport, with football coming on very, very strong with its violence and movement and things like that. But baseball put on its greatest show during that Red Sox-Reds confrontation, and that Game 6 alone had so many dramatic shifts, even before Fisk's walk-off homer that he body-Englished into the night, post midnight, like 12:20 Eastern time. It really put baseball back on the map. Even some intellectual like Ken Burns said he was a hippie who had moved away from the game, but the 75 World Series drew him back in.
Now, I want to go back to something you said about Vec and broadcasting. Broadcasting is kind of a counterintuitive aspect of the game. On the one hand, it does bring the product to a lot more people, but owners were very worried early on that it would keep them away. Why would they bother coming to the game if they could get it for free? So could you – there are a few chapters in here about broadcasting, either television or radio, so could you chat about that a bit?
Well, overall, broadcasting has expanded baseball's reach. It's expanded its fan base, and it was a free advertisement for the game. And owners did not understand. A lot of owners did not understand that early on. They thought that anything that gave away the game free to the consumer at home would hurt it. That's why a lot of owners, when television came in, initially, you know, had all their games on TV and then withdrew it as TV became popular, thinking that it would absolutely hurt the gate. But what it does is, before a young child actually has the ability to buy a ticket, he learns to love the game via TV or radio. Look how popular Harry Carey was as a Cardinals radio announcer in a multi-state region around Missouri in the 50s and 60s. He helped build up the regional draw of the Cardinals. All Cub games were on TV from the dawn of TV, and even though the kids couldn't get out to the games, they would run home from school, me included, to see the last couple of innings on TV. That turned over into ticket buyers, you know, down the line. And finally, broadcasting has showered baseball with untold billions, and as a direct correlation to the salary explosion starting in the late 1980s, as rights increases, rights fees became, you know, greater, you had the owners spending their broadcast money as soon as they got it in to lure the best players as free agents.
In doing research for your book, what surprised you the most?
I don't know if anything surprised me the most. I'd say one thing is the owner's resistance to television. I don't think anything surprised me. I think on the Black Sox thing, I think Landis's absolute intransigence in banning both the active participants in the in the gambling scandal, also somebody like Buck Weaver, that was really something where he just went. He was using draconian methods to purge the game of gambling. I didn't realize that even after the Black Sox, that there were players that he banned. And obviously it worked, because Pete Rose is the only serious gambling scandal since the 1920s. I'm kind of surprised that that it took so long to name an African-American manager. But when you look at it, that was at about the period of time that a lot of other things in society, a lot of other barriers were finally falling, that even as African-Americans got their civil rights, there were still various ceilings that prevented them from rising into prominent positions of society.
I'm constantly amazed how there's always something coming out about the Black Sox, even after all this time.
Yeah, it's but that was the culmination of something that had to happen. Gambling was had so permeated the game. There were so many other attempts at game fixing, and there were probably a lot of people that got away with a lot of things in the late 19th and early 20th century. It literally was something that came to a head. But the tragic thing about the Black Sox scandal was not just the banning of the players involved, the shoeless Joe Jacksons of the world, and an innocent, I would say, well, a bystander. He wasn't innocent, but a bystander who didn't participate about it in Buck Weaver. But it relegated the White Sox to a permanent number two position in the Chicago market. And they've been unable to become the preeminent team that they were early in the 20th century, because the franchise is literally torn apart by Landis's mass banning.
Now, there are 50 game changers in here. 50 is a very nice round number. Were there some that you eliminated, some that you were considering, but that didn't quite make the cut?
There were a few, but I wouldn't say there were 100 game changers. I had a pretty good idea in my mind who would make the cut. And the good thing about this, Ron, is that I had covered some of these game changers myself in my decades as a baseball writer. I'll give you a quick example. Barry Bonds absolutely has to make it, not because of his use of PEDs. PEDs was a game changer in itself, but not singling out one guy. But the fact of his off-putting personality being a being somebody who would not be a role model to counteract Jordan for minority kids, as Hank Aaron had been a role model, as other players before him had been a role model. And using an interview I did with Bonds 20 years ago was a great frame of reference. So I had quite a bit of original source material for this, and I had some pretty you know, well-thought-out opinions about it. I would say newspapers came in at the last minute because I just kept seeing how coverage was being cut, and the fans were not benefiting from that. So I don't think I had double the number of game changers, and I had to winnow it down. It was a question of putting it in the right order and saying one is more important than the other. The reason why I picked Babe Ruth number one over Jackie Robinson is that Ruth changed the game in the snap of his fingers and a swing of his bat, where Robinson almost is shared with the rest of the country. He's almost a life and society game changer, whereas the changes he brought about had to take place over a 12-year period until all teams finally were integrated.
So if this book went into extra innings and you had one more to go, what would have been the 51st game changer?
Oh, I don't know. I would say probably the rise of ticket prices. I think that baseball was once a very, very accessible game. You could wake up in the morning and decide to go out and sit in the cheap seats at Wrigley Field or Comiskey Park, where I am in Chicago. Now you've got to plan your visit months in advance, because they sell the majority of tickets in advance. The tickets are much more expensive. They're $30, $40, $50 for a good seat. And you cannot go to as many games as you used to when those tickets were a dollar a head. So I think that that impacts the number of games and the number of exposures and how fans behave compared to the way it was 40 years ago.
One thing that came to my mind that I might have wanted to see in there was the preponderance now of fantasy baseball.
Yeah, that was under consideration for me. I don't know if that change the game. It's become a new activity for fans. I tried fantasy baseball once, and I had so much experience with real baseball, covering and dovetailing and reacting with real players, that it was too time-consuming, and you had to be literally a stats geek, keeping up with the daily things, and I just didn't do that. So I never became a fantasy baseball practitioner myself, and to me, It's personally, if not for others, but it's off the grid for me.
And we've been talking with George Castle, whose new book is Baseball's Game Changers by Lions Press. George, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled that you've enjoyed the book, Ron.
And that was our baseball conversation with George Castle. Tune in again next time when we'll have another interesting guest from the world of baseball pop culture. And remember, this is the time of year when baseball books will be coming out fast and furious. So tune in to Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf. Rather, visit ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf.com and send me an email with questions, suggestions, whatever, at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you later.
Seen Matty pitching that fader so grand, he'd have said, "Boys, I'm glad I discovered this land. Gee, it's a wonderful game."